In our first session on Daniel, we left off at slide number 6, as well as dealing with some of the other background issues. And I want to remind you what the big picture is in Daniel before we get into details. The big picture, the thing that Daniel and all the exiles needed to see while they were away from their land, was that even though their country had been conquered, so-called by the greater country, the bigger country, the more strong country, Babylon, in reality, Babylon was not the stronger country. Israel was actually the stronger country. The God of Israel was actually greater than the gods of Babylon or any other country. But it didn't look that way. And why did it not look that way? Because the exiles were under God's discipline. And just because a believer is under the discipline of God and looks like his God or her God is not very strong, that's not the reality. Often the reality is what it doesn't appear to be, right? And that was certainly the case for Daniel, because Daniel had several visions in this book about how the God of Israel was the God over all gods, the universal king. So his universal sovereignty was going to be manifested over all nations until he established it once again on earth after this period of time called the times of the Gentiles. You grasping what the times of the Gentiles means? We don't have that actual phrase here in the book of Daniel, but I think it's still the overall view that Jesus is looking back on in Luke 21:24. Continue on where we were before. The covenant of an imposter Messiah in the mold of Antiochus will be squelched and replaced with the true Messiah who alone keeps his covenants. So part of what's going to happen during this times of the Gentiles is that imposters are going to come up and pretend they're the Messiah. We see this happened at least a couple times in the book of Daniel that are looking to the future from Daniel's perspective. One is a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, who is a ruler who came 300 years after the time, actually 500 years after the time of Daniel, 167 BC. And this ruler, Greek ruler, who had control over Jerusalem for just 3 years, 3.5 years, looked like, you know, he was the sovereign one because he put the Jews under persecution. He's actually predicted almost 450 years in advance in Daniel 11. But his rule is going to be actually depicting one who's even farther in the future, who's also going to persecute the Jews. This ruler, called the Antichrist, is spoken of in chapter 9, verse 27, and then also at the end of chapter 11, at least a couple times in the book. And he's going to make a covenant with Israel. Doesn't specifically say what the covenant is, but it's part of the covenant teaching of the book of Daniel. The true God keeps the true covenant. The false Messiah, this future Antichrist, is going to make a covenant with Israel, but he's going to break his covenant in contrast to the true Messiah who keeps his covenant. Does that make sense? That's how you can tell whether somebody's really the true Messiah or not. Do they keep to their word? That's how you can tell whether people are reliable or not. Do they keep their word? But we see in terms of redemption that God alone saves, since all other kingdoms and rulers are ultimately powerless. It's an interesting thing to see that these kings that appear and then are powerful for a while, but then are deposed, they repeatedly keep saying, the God of Daniel is the highest of all gods. Did they actually come into a personal relationship with this God? I can't say they did. But we find Nebuchadnezzar, Darius, making these declarations that God is the God of Daniel is actually the true God. It's quite amazing, especially when he sees Daniel delivered in very unlikely ways, and his friends delivered. We find messianic teaching in the book because here we find that the actual date of Messiah's coming is predicted in the book of Daniel. Did you catch what I just said? We've seen many, many predictions in the prophets of Messiah coming. We saw Micah say, oh, he's going to be born in Bethlehem. Very specific. We see others say he's going to come to reign. We see Isaiah saying he's going to come and have all kinds of prophecies fulfilled in Isaiah 53 about his death. None of those are as specific as we find in Daniel chapter 9. That actually predicts the very day that Jesus is presented to Israel. It is the most specific prophecy you'll find in the Old Testament. It's the most specific prophecy you'll find in the Bible. I believe it's the most specific prophecy you'll find that actually came true, probably in human history. And we'll get into that, and I'll explain about Daniel 9 in a minute. And that itself, saying that the Messiah is going to come and then later he's going to die, proves that Christ will also defeat the world's kingdoms that is also depicted in these images, especially chapter 2, where Christ and his kingdom is the rock that goes and crashes at the base of this statue representing the world powers. It's absolutely amazing. I never realized there was a verse in the Bible like this until I actually got into Daniel 9 and studied it for myself. So here's a big picture again on our chart. The universal sovereignty in times of the Gentiles. Daniel is depicting how the God of Israel, the God of Daniel, the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is actually the high God of all gods. And frankly, he's the only God. It doesn't get into that like Isaiah does, where Isaiah says there's one God, there's only one. We don't find that depiction in Daniel like we find in Isaiah. But we do find that God is over all. And you'll see that the book breaks up into three different areas, all relating to the idea of sovereignty. First of all, God is sovereign over Daniel, chapter 1. Then God is sovereign over Gentiles, chapters 2 to 7, which interestingly switched into Aramaic, goes from Hebrew to Aramaic. And then God is sovereign over Jews, or God is sovereign over Israel, in the last part, which shifts back to Hebrew. So this book is actually in its original in both Hebrew and Aramaic, and the section in the middle that relates to the Gentiles is in the Gentile language, Aramaic, the trade language of the day that came from Aram, or modern-day Syria, and that was the lingua franca of the ancient Near East. All the various nations did their business with one another in Aramaic, even as countries today do their business in English. You know, China is going to relate to Saudi Arabia in English, essentially. Francophone Africa is going to relate to Argentina, not in French or Spanish, but they're going to talk English. English is really the world language. So in similar manner, we see the central part of the book of Daniel like that. Feel free to interject your comment or question as we go along, okay? You have any question about that? Some of you look like, I got a question. Yes, Carla.
I'm curious. Is there another book that's also written?
We do have, there are other portions of Ezra in Aramaic. And Ezra is written also in the Persian era, where Aramaic became very popular. And the letters from the Persian kings over to the people who return back to the land, we'll see later on when we study Ezra, are written in Aramaic. In other words, they're not translated. Aramaic is very similar to Hebrew. You know, they look quite similar, but they are actually different languages. And one of the key issues in this book is Daniel's faith. And so Huddleston, in the Acrostic Summarized Bible, he has Daniel's faith as the summary of the whole thing. By the way, looking at this picture, there's something in this picture that really looks It's not really quite biblical. Can you tell what it is? Oh, yeah, there's a little mouse there along with the lions. That's true. I didn't notice the mouse. There's two things that's biblical, not biblical. His arrogance? Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. If this picture looks like he's depicting that he's arrogant instead of confident in the Lord, that would be true. Look at the age of Daniel. Too old, too young? We get into Daniel chapter 6. And Daniel 6 takes place during the time of Darius. In other words, it's in the Persian era. In other words, Daniel has been in the land of Israel for 60 years, something like that. 70 years. He looks a little young to me, but anyway. The artist is really, he's a great artist. So give credit to the artist. He can draw far better than I can. But anyway. But I wouldn't, just knowing what we know about Daniel, we would say that he is not actually arrogant, because Daniel is constantly giving deference to the Lord. When the king says, "Wow, you know how to interpret visions," every time Daniel says, "It's not me. There is a God in heaven who reveals these things." He's constantly deferring to the Lord. He's frankly a good example to us when people compliment us. This idea of the self-made man, there's no such thing. When people compliment you, it's a great idea to defer that to the Lord, to say, "Hey, you know, if you think I know something, well, you should have had the teachers I had." I can read fast. Well, my mother taught me how to read fast, you know, or whatever it might be. If they compliment you, especially for the way you look, can you take credit for that? Thank your mother. Thank your father. Thank God. There's always a opportunity to give deference to somebody else. And what we find in the book of Daniel is a confidence in him. But I call this book, in terms of its application, be confident. God wants us to be confident like Daniel, but that confidence is not in ourselves. There's a lot of worldly teaching that goes around that says, you need confidence, you struggle with confidence, well, believe in yourself. And the way they put it here is, be you, in red here. So the idea is if you be you, then you'll be confident. Now, do you think that's true? I think a lot of us will say, well, if I'm really me, I don't think I'm going to be confident. Being me is not exuding confidence, because we don't feel that confident about ourselves. And so it raises this question, what do you really need to know to truly be confident? I think this is the question the book is answering. What would be some truths? We're going to look at three in the book. What are three truths that will help you truly be confident? And I'll give you a hint. The truths don't relate to you. They relate to God. They relate to what God is doing. And again, back to our theme here of the book being the universal sovereignty of God. So here's the first truth that will help you be confident. Know this truth. God rules over you. And I really believe if you know that God is the one who's directing the events of your life, then you will be confident. Even the things that you don't like, even the things that are of great inconvenience to you, if you recognize that the Lord controls what happens to you as an individual, you can see something even as tragic as exile getting your whole country getting destroyed and getting kicked out of your country and being put in about the most pagan environment that mankind has ever experienced. That's what you've got in Babylon. There was no nation that ever had more gods than Babylon back then and even to our present day. They're the most idolatrous nation ever in the existence of humankind. And here's Daniel taken away as a young man, probably like a teenager, maybe 14, 15 years old. And he's thrust into this environment where there's all this pressure to conform to the Babylonian way of life. He's learning Babylonian language, Babylonian literature, certainly Babylonian gods. And how does he respond? He recognizes that God ruled over him, that God knew what he was doing in his life. God was actually preparing him to be his representative in Babylon for the Jewish people. We find when we get to the middle section of the book that God rules over all nations. And I know in my own life that if I'm recognizing that God controls what happens to the peoples of the world, I really don't get so stressed out about what's happening with this nation against this nation and my own nation. When I see difficulties that come, I realize that God has his own plan here. When the hurricanes and the earthquakes come, when the political chaos comes, when people make bad decisions and vote in stupid laws, and I've seen that happen so many times, the people ask for a stupid law. It's not even imposed upon them. I realize that, wow, God still rules over all nations. He rules over my country. He rules over your country. And he knows what he's doing. That's what we find in the middle section, because Daniel finds that, yes, the Babylonians are ruling, but guess who's following? The Medes and the Persians are able to conquer the Babylonians. And then guess what? The Medes and the Persians are going to be conquered by the Greeks. And the Greeks are going to rule for a while, and then the Romans are going to conquer. He gets it all laid out for him in these chapters. I mean, how many of us know that? How many of us could say we know what the superpower of the world's going to be a century from now or 500 years from now? None of us knows. I read somewhere that some people are predicting that the country of Yemen would be the world's capital within 100 years. Yemen? And I go, are you kidding? That's going to be the world's financial center and the world's center of influence? I would say, no. But what if God said that it was going to be the case? What if God said at the time of Daniel, as he did, that this tiny city of what we call Rome right now, that was just a little hamlet there in Italy, that city would actually become so influential that there would be a Roman Empire. At the time of Daniel, you would have thought that's absolutely crazy. All those little Italian city-states are all fighting against one another. I'm talking about 600 BC. It would have been ridiculous. But God knew that he was raising up the Romans, and they would come to power, and they would actually be the world power 6 centuries after Daniel. And then thirdly, the third thing that you can and should realize, and I should realize to be truly confident, is that God rules over Israel's future. He gives many prophetic fulfillments here, some of which, predictions, some of which were fulfilled. Actually, there's over 100 prophecies that have already been fulfilled in Daniel 8 to 12. And there are dozens of others in this section that are yet to be fulfilled with the nation of Israel. Don't you think that would have given Daniel just a whole lot of confidence to know that God was going to take care of his own country They're not going to remain in Babylon forever. He's actually going to bring them back. But in this section, we find that God has a plan, and a portion of it is 490 years yet to come. And God's going to be working within that 490-year period we find in Daniel 9, the last few verses. Wouldn't that be incredible for you to get that kind of a vision of what's happening about your country? Seriously, Lord? You're going to tell me what's going to happen 5 centuries from now in my country? And beyond that? That's the big picture of what we find here. I think the main idea of Daniel is that God controls each level. He controls all creation. He's sovereign over the universe. So that means the individual level, he's sovereign over you as an individual. That means all nations, none excepted, he's sovereign over all those nations. And then thirdly, he's sovereign over his people, Israel, which would have been the key nation in Daniel's life. So in terms of how this book applies, recognize God's sovereignty over all authority in history. We should not be people that worry. We should be people that submit to the sovereignty and authority of God. Resist evil without compromising is a key message in the book of Daniel. We find 3 major stories. Well, I guess I could say more than that, but chapter 1, Daniel has to resist eating compromised food that would be unlawful for Jews to eat. He passes a test. Chapter 3, his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they are put to the test at the risk of their lives of whether they're going to bow down to this statue. And they resist that evil of idolatry without compromising, and God protects them. And then we get to chapter 6, and Daniel, by this time, he's an old man. And the question is, when the king makes this edict that he cannot pray to any god except for, well, the king, as if the king could answer all these prayers, what will Daniel do now as an old man in his 80s? Is he going to show the same kind of faithfulness he had as a teenager 70 years earlier? Or is he going to be, shall I say, like many, many people today who lose their spiritual edge when they get into their 70s and their 80s? And they end up compromising? You would think that people would really be spiritually strong in their latter years because they've seen so much of God's faithfulness in their lives. But oftentimes it doesn't happen. And people don't have that spiritual vibrancy in their senior years that they had earlier. You've seen it happen, haven't you? I mean, how many people do you know in their 80s that really truly have a real vital walk with the Lord? I know some, but I believe they are the exception. More difficult, yes, to go to church, so I stopped going to church because it's more difficult because of the signs of aging and all that. So trust God for your ultimate salvation so that you can endure to the end. Also is another one. We trust God for our salvation by faith, right? But do we continue to trust God to give us the kind of endurance, the kind of perseverance, even to the end? The book of Daniel sets up examples of people who do that. And they are written so that the Jews in exile would be encouraged to continue following the Lord despite the fact that they're brought out of their homeland. And it should be an encouragement for you and me as well. Because as far as I know, none of us here are in exile. I don't know too many people in exile, except for one of my friends from South Africa, who has essentially been kicked out of South Africa because she's a white, and all these influences in South Africa are persecuting and even killing and pushing out white farmers, especially. And so we find people of exile. One of my friends from South Africa recently became a Singaporean because there's really no opportunity to go back. But in any case, we need to go beyond the knowledge, knowing the Lord. We need to go to persevering for the Lord. And that's what these examples do. Seek God in prayer and intercession is another great application we find in the school. Over and over, we find Daniel going to the Lord, praying to God, even when his life is at stake. Now, if your life was at stake because the ruler says you cannot pray to any other god, my guess is you'd still continue praying, right? Would you do it 3 times a day, and would you do it with the windows open so that everybody can see up to your room? They don't even have to come into your room. They can see down from below. There you are, praying at the window with your face toward Jerusalem. That was the kind of courage that Daniel shows in chapter 6. He's not hiding. I think he says to himself, well, the Lord's given me the interpretations of these visions, and the king knows I'm worshiping the true God, so there's no secrecy here. He already knows that. So let me give him more evidence that I'm really following the true God. Live a godly life. All this results when we do the first four. We're basically living a person who is like God. Godly means like God. Godly means that you're seeking to do the things that God would do if he was in human flesh like you and in the same situation as you. Wow. And we've said it maybe as, what would Jesus do in our recent days? And so those are some of the ways that the book of Daniel shows up in our lives. Okay. Just take a quick break and see. Do you have any questions? Anything in particular that you want to ask about what I've said so far? No? You guys are good? Yes?
It seems like not just that about the prophecy, that is actually more of recounting history. So it seems quite a lot of literature actually also, mention this.
Very good point. Okay, the question then becomes, when Daniel gives these successive kingdoms, is he recounting history or is he predicting what will be history? This is a really big question, which relates to the issue of when Daniel wrote. So the question then becomes essentially, who wrote the book of Daniel? And this book has been, I'm going to jump to slide 97. We know from internal evidence that the first person is used from Daniel 7, verse 2, all the way to chapter 12, verse 13. In several other places, we've got Daniel recording it. This is what happened to me. You can pick any one of these. I'll just pick by a random here. Chapter 8, verse 1, in the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision. All right. So, is this actually written by Daniel? Or is it not written by Daniel? Are we being deceived? Chapter 8 is a big chapter. Chapter 8 actually predicts 300 years in advance Alexander the Great coming on the scene. So, was this actually written after Alexander conquered the known world? Or is it written before that? We actually have in the history when Alexander made his way to Jerusalem. This is like 331, believe that, I think 331 BC. When he made his way to Jerusalem, he didn't actually conquer Jerusalem. Jerusalem opened its doors to Alexander the Great. He was brought up to the temple, and the high priest read Daniel chapter 8 to him. And he said that this was predicted 300 years ago that you would you would be raised up by God to conquer the known world. Well, Alexander was quite amazed to see that, and there was no, and Jerusalem actually was not conquered, like many, many other cities were conquered by Alexander. So there's a depiction right there that says that this had been in the history for several hundred years. We also find some other external evidence, like Ezekiel 14:14. Ezekiel says to God, from Babylon, the same place where Daniel was, and actually the Lord says to him, Ezekiel 14:14, Son of Man, he says, I'm really going to read in 13. The Lord says to him, Son of Man, if a country sins against me by being unfaithful, and I stretch out my hand against it to cut off its food supply and send famine upon it and kill its men and their animals. God says, this is the judgment I'm going to have happen on Jerusalem, Ezekiel. You're not there, but this is what I've decreed. Then if the people of Israel no longer stray from me, they will not defile themselves anymore with all their sins, then they'll be my people and I will be their God, declares the Lord. Oh, whoops, sorry. I jumped up to verse 11. He says, verse 14, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they could save only themselves by their righteousness, declares the sovereign Lord. You catch what God's saying here? Saying, you, Ezekiel, you're in exile, but these other people, they're living in a condemned city. And I am going to destroy Jerusalem because Jerusalem has filled up their sins. But there could be some righteous people there. Let's suppose Noah was there. Let's suppose Daniel was there. Let's suppose Job was there. Those individuals could save themselves by their righteousness. I'll get them out of the city. They won't die. We're talking about temporal salvation here. We're talking about being delivered from death. Do you see what God's saying to Ezekiel? He's saying that Daniel existed during the time of Ezekiel, who's a contemporary with Daniel, probably about the same age. So if you're going to argue that the book of Daniel was written hundreds of years later after all these kingdoms came and left, then you're going to have to argue the same for Ezekiel, which, you know, some people may want to do that as well. But what we actually got happening here is we have Daniel living 605 to 536 during, there's the time of the exile where he's there, and his ministry is going on around 600 BC, but his prophecies stretch all the way from his own time all the way to AD 70. And one of the key things he mentions is in chapter 11, of Antiochus, who desecrates the temple. So the critics say, well, we have to date it after that. We have to see these are actually historical events, but they're recorded as quote-unquote prophecies. And that will explain, because after all, Daniel couldn't have known the future. He couldn't have known which nations were going to come, which nations were going to go. That's the critic's argument. But the Dead Sea Scrolls actually proves a conservative dating of the book of Daniel. We have these various scrolls, like, for example, Isaiah scroll and all kinds of scrolls. But there's also a Daniel scroll found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, as conservatives, we date the book of Daniel 560 BC, right around there, Daniel's lifetime. The liberals would date it 164 BC. What we find in the Dead Sea Scrolls, though, is a copy of the Daniel scroll that is dated from 200 to 100 BC. The Dead Sea Scrolls were way away, far away from where Daniel was. They're over the land of Israel, and they're in an obscure community at the Dead Sea. Are we really to believe that Daniel wrote in Babylon, and it got copied and was brought over to Israel and made its way into the Dead Sea community? within this short time period, between 164 and as early as 100. And some would date it actually at 200 BC. Have you ever seen a copy of a book before the book was written? Doesn't happen, right? You got to write the book first, and then the copy comes later. Actually, the word Daniel means God, or El, is my judge. God is the judge. God is the one who knows the future. God is the one who knows all things. Some call this the apocalypse of the Old Testament. It's interesting, Daniel was different from the other prophets because he kept his profession as a politician. And as I noted, actually the date is debated more than any other biblical book. Because it's so specific, the critics don't want to say, oh, this really was written by Daniel. It has to be written centuries later. If they can prove that, then they can say, well, the Bible really doesn't have predictive prophecy. We've also seen that it's written in two languages. It's recorded outside of Israel. God saw Daniel's rule over the nations. And it talks about the times of the Gentiles that Jesus noted in Luke 21:24. So those are some of the unique elements to Daniel's prophecy. All right, let me see if I can give you a quick survey of what we actually have happening as we go into the various chapters. We know in Daniel 1 that these handsome men are taken from their land to get their MDiv degree. All right? This is a MDiv because they're supposed to be masters in divinities, plural. All right? They were brought there to learn all this stuff about Babylon. And they were to be trained, Daniel 1, verse 5 says, for 3 years. After that, they were to enter the king's service. So it must be an MDiv. It's 3 years, right? Their names were changed. Daniel, God is my judge, was changed to Bel, protect his life, Belteshazzar. Hananiah's name was changed from the Lord to the moon god, the command of moon. Mishael, whose name means what is God? Who is what God is? His name is changed to Meshach. Who is what Aku is? And Azariah, whose name means the Lord helps, or whom the Lord helps, his name was also named after a pagan deity. All four of the men got pagan names. It's the exact opposite of what some of you experienced. You had pagan names, and then you became Christian, and then you got a Christian name. Some of my friends are named Daniel, but they were not they didn't grow up in Christian homes. They took on the name Daniel later on. This is the opposite. Though those names are hard to remember. If you just remember Shadchak, Meshach, and a bungalow, then it'll help you remember these guys. Shadrach, Meshach, and a bungalow. I mean, a Bendigo. Sometimes it doesn't help, does it? But the point here in chapter 1 is their names are changed, they're brought out, they don't have their parents with them anymore, they're alone in the palace, they have all this pagan influence, pagan food, pagan ideas, and all this, and they're able to say no to eat this food that was against the law. It doesn't say what the food was. Presumably, it didn't pass Leviticus 11. It had the various food laws that said that, you know, you can't eat certain things. And I bet it was really, really good food. This is at the palace. I shouldn't show you pictures like this right before lunch, but your hunger will be satisfied. Daniel's food was a food of choice, was not the king's choice food. He just says, give us vegetables. Just 10 days. And water. We don't need all the wine. We don't need all that. It's probably exotic kinds of food that didn't pass the Leviticus 11 test. Now, do you think this food really did help him? Any of you ever done this? 10 days, just vegetables? My wife and I did a five weeks of just vegetables once. Actually, we felt pretty good. But nobody came up to me and said, wow, you really look so great. Let's put you in the king's service, you know? And that was after 5 weeks, you know? these guys are just doing this for a week and a half. I think God himself just honored them and said, you're going to honor me? I'm going to honor you. I'm going to make the other guys look bad. I'm going to make you guys look good. And it wasn't the food, so don't go looking up on the internet the Daniel's diet, the 10-day detox and weight loss plan. Even though it's a good thing, I think, to have some times where you eat vegetables and all that. Because if you do it, this guy's going to make $28 selling you his book and all that. The point is not the diet. The point is their faith in the true God in a very difficult situation. And at the end of it, we see verse 20, and every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And then the last, and Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. Now, we look at that and we go, oh yeah, first year of King Cyrus. Huh? Who's he? What's that? We don't realize, King Cyrus, you're supposed to go, King Cyrus? That means all the way through all the Babylonian kings. You mean to say Daniel was there 70 years later and still serving in the palace? That's what you're supposed to read when you look at the last verse of Daniel 1. What? Who could have lasted in the palace 70 years with king after king after king, with all these kings coming and going and all this turbulence and the whole kingdom of Babylon being conquered by the Persians? You mean to say that Daniel was still there? Yep. And he had a role to play to the Persians. 539, 538, 536 BC. It's amazing. It's amazing. When I look at this, I think, what about our own Christian teenagers today? About you and me? We're all past the teenage age, but are we training our teenagers so that they would truly continue following the Lord? If they were uprooted from Singapore and brought to a pagan land, would they really hold to godly values? I'm afraid that what the answer might be, that is really not the case. So I apply Daniel 1 by saying, be confident in your pagan setting that God can help you not violate your godly convictions. Because every one of us here is in a godless setting. We're going to leave this room and we're going to go out there and we're going to interact with people today that have values that are just totally contrary to everything that we've learned in the book of Daniel. Question is, will you be a model exile? In a sense, you are an exile because you're a citizen of heaven and you're not home yet. Wherever you go here on earth is actually exile. You go back to your country, wherever it might be. You're still an exile because your values don't match the worldly values of where you grew up and where you're going. And this book can help us really gain courage that God knows what he's doing and all of that. So that's the idea of God rules over you. Well, we see in the next section, God rules over all nations. I've jumped to slide 154 for those of you following along on the. And chapter 2 gets us into, well, here's basically the point. The exiles could confidently trust God's sovereignty over the nations, seen in Daniel's devotion and prophecy of the times of the Gentiles. In other words, Daniel saw world history, but he saw world history in advance. So I don't know if you'd call it world history. We call it world history. Daniel would call it the days ahead. And it starts with a statue. Nebuchadnezzar recognized God's sovereignty in his dream of the destruction of the statue. And so Nebuchadnezzar has this dream. And he's sort of like playing games with his magicians and enchanters here, because he doesn't actually tell them what the dream is in chapter 2. So he calls them all and he says, you tell me the dream. And they go, no, you tell us the dream and we'll tell the interpretation. And he goes, no, you tell me the dream first. He's testing them to find out, am I just paying you and you're just sitting around doing nothing? Are you really in touch with the gods or not? And then they come again. Well, no one can ever do this. They set up the scene perfectly. No one. Because the only one who knows what's going to happen, what happened in your dream, are the gods. You know, if I asked you, I had a dream last night. Can you tell me what it is? I don't think any of you could tell me what it was. If you could, you wouldn't be just a mind reader. You would be in touch with a whole other realm, God. God himself would have to be willing to show it to you. So we see Daniel actually coming before him, and he interprets this dream of this amazing statue that has all these different images in it. The head of gold, the chest of silver, and the arms, the waist, thighs of bronze, and then iron legs. And iron mixed with clay as feet. I tell you, if you told me you had this kind of vision, even if I knew you had this kind of vision, I'd have no idea what you're talking about. I go, why don't they make the whole statue? Why out of one element, one material, you know? And then this stone that's cut out of the hills is sent, and it's crushed. It hits the feet, interestingly, of the statue, and then the whole statue comes down. What in the world is this vision talking about? Well, even if these others didn't know the vision, well, they certainly wouldn't know what these various elements actually were referring to. Especially this last one, this stone that just comes out of the sky and crushes the feet. Well, Daniel says these are actually five different kingdoms. Babylon followed by the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans. And then the kingdom of Antichrist, yet future. These five kingdoms will actually be destroyed by the kingdom of God, the kingdom of Christ, the kingdom of Messiah. And, this whole issue becomes a bad habit. The image becomes a bad habit. In chapter 2, the many materials, when we get to chapter 3, becomes all gold. And here we get Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It seems like I've got the wrong three guys here. Standing alone. And they know by standing alone, they're actually going to get thrown into this furnace of fire. But God gives protection to them and even adds to their numbers. The three become four because I think it's the pre-incarnate, the Lord Jesus, who's with them. And so the whole thing ends up with the king pronouncing, wow, your God is greater than all gods. You know, he promotes them. Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he says in chapter 3, verse 28. Getting into chapter 4, we see the king has this vision of a tree which actually is representing him, this great tree that gets cut down. And it does happen to him. In his pride, he says, this is about a year later. By my own mighty power, I built Babylon, you know, my royal... It's all ridiculous because he actually didn't build it. And so I call it involuntary vegetarianism that comes about. Remember back in chapter 1, it was voluntary vegetarianism with Daniel and his friends. Here it's involuntary. He eats grass. He can't even clip his nails because he lives with the animals, frankly, for 6 years. And this probably fits in, I would say it likely fits in during this time, during the siege of Tyre. So, bottom line, the narrative, when we get to this middle section, it has a chiastic structure, as we've seen in other places. The focal point is the middle of these chapters, from chapters 2 to 7, where Nebuchadnezzar is humbled, and then we see Belshazzar humbled as well in chapter 5. Belshazzar ends up doing something really stupid, calling for the items from the temple. And you'll see on the front of your notes the depiction of Belshazzar drinking from the goblets from the temple. Even an average Hebrew didn't do that. Those were for the priests, not even for your normal, you know, run-of-the-mill Jew. And he ends up being humbled to the extent that God actually helps the Persians to cut off the water north of Babylon and the Euphrates River and divert the water so that they are able to enter underneath the water gates into the city. And to this day, Babylon has not been rebuilt. We're talking about Daniel's feast, where Belshazzar actually was killed that very night. And Cyrus the Persian ended up taking control. The same sort of issue happens in chapter 7 with nations depicted by different animals. The same nations: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greeks, and Romans. God knows history is the point here. When we get to chapter 8, we actually have the two center nations, the Medes and Persians and the Greeks, highlighted with the imagery of a ram and a goat. We see this ram not even touching the ground, beating, did I say ram? A goat not even touching the ground, beating a ram. If you put a goat against a ram, the goat's never going to win, right? Goats are just little weak animals. But this one is the kind of goat that no one would ever have imagined, that Alexander, 300 years after the time of Daniel, would face the ram in the east, and Alexander, as a strong goat, tiny, would go and actually defeat the Persians, and his empire get broken up, depicted as four different horns that ended up becoming the four different divisions of the Greek Empire that came up after Alexander. All these are very, very specific prophecies. The most specific of all is the one when we get into Daniel 9, where he's wondering how long it's going to be, and he sees it's going to be close because he reads Jeremiah. It says the exile is going to be 70 years. So the angel comes to Daniel and he says to him, the end of Daniel 9, "Know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens." Everybody understands these sevens to be years. In other words, we've got 483 years. 69 sevens, 69 times seven is 483 years. He's saying that the Messiah is going to come 483 years after that. And then there'll be a last seven, a seven-year period. Well, I'll spare you the details, but if you count the days here, the actual number of days, 173,880 days, it actually ends up being the 30th of March, AD 33. This is the day that Jesus entered into Jerusalem. And you can actually, if you do the math on this, you can actually figure, as I have on page 553, using the Jewish calendar, it's 173,880 days. It ends up being 30th of March, AD 33. If you use the Gregorian calendar, 365 days a year with leap years, you add all that in, it's the same. Even if you use the astronomical calendar, you know what our year is. It's 365.24219879 days, in case you're wondering how long the year is. That's how long we know from astronomy that the year is. That actually also works out to be 173,880 days, ending March 30th, AD 33. It says, after that, the Messiah will be cut off. And we know, just a few days later, the 3rd of April, AD 33, that Jesus died on the cross. This is the most specific prophecy of the Bible. And it's depicting that time period. We also find from Daniel that this 70th week says that the one who will come, referring to one who's like the one who destroys Jerusalem, is going to make a covenant for 7 years with Israel. He will confirm a covenant for 1 7, Daniel 9:27 says. But in the middle of the seven, he'll put an end to sacrifice. In other words, he's going to cut his covenant off, or he's going to break his covenant. But notice what that's saying. He's going to end sacrifice. That means there has to be sacrifices that are reestablished before that point. Does that make sense? If the sacrifices are going to be restored before that point, that would mean that you're going to have a sacrificial system restored in Jerusalem. And we actually have the Temple Institute and others that are seeking to rebuild the temple today. It's going to take God to knock off the Dome of the Rock for that to happen. Or some would say that the temple's actually going to be built right next door to the Dome of the Rock. In either case, it's obviously going to be God who is depicting all of this in the days yet ahead for all of that to actually take place. When we get to Daniel, I'm just going to jump to Daniel 11 in lieu of time here. We have over 100 prophecies of the king of the north, the Greek Seleucid kings, against the Greek Ptolemaic kings, fighting back and forth over Israel. It's over and over and over. And you can trace through all that, and you will find over 100 prophecies that where God actually put all those things, those even Cleopatra and all these various things, even bringing the ships from the western coastlines into it, where the Romans got involved into this. It all actually happened exactly as Daniel said it would happen. Until we get to the end of Daniel 11, that shows Daniel actually being invaded, the land of Israel actually being invaded by that. And bringing us finally to the end of the book of Daniel, where we find the prophecies of God doing incredible things and preserving his people even to the end. I hope you gain courage from that, from seeing what God is doing now and will do in the days ahead.